Welcome to today's featured interview here on Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, and today we are joined by one of our fan favorite guests, David Dubine from the channel Adapt 2030. He's also a contributing host to Brighteon.tv. He's a researcher and analyst that has fantastic information about what's affecting the food supply. And today the topic is the cover story for the food shortages that are already emerging. So welcome to the show, David Dubine. It's always an honor to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for bringing me on. I know we only meet when I have something new to bring out instead of just regurgitating old and trying to re-spin it. This is something new that's happened since the Chevelouche eruption, April 10th. What we're starting to see is sulfur dioxide spinning around the northern hemisphere around 60 degrees north latitude, but it's being caught up in the polar easterlies, causing spinning and cavitation in the atmosphere, and that is going to wind its way all around the Arctic Circle, and the dome of our planet will be covered with sulfur dioxide for the next year and a half.
Wow.
Approximately. So look out for something strange with the sea ice to occur.
Okay, so wait a second. You sent me a PowerPoint. So if you tell me a slide number, I'll show that slide for people so they can see what you're seeing. Where do you want to begin on that presentation?
7-6-6-7. You should see a picture of the globe on the left there.
Oh, okay. 6. Okay. Got it.
Yeah, it says polar easterlies with the Hadley cells.
Yep. All right. And tell us, what are Hadley cells?
Those are the cloud cells of our planet. The most famous is the Hadley cell. Now, these are the convection that drives the weather systems literally on our planet. The conversion of energies and differentials in pressure from the equator up to the different polar latitudes, whether it's South Pole at the Antarctic or North Pole here that we understand in the Arctic.
Okay.
So this eruption occurred right at 60 degrees north latitude, which is really interesting because it's at that conversion zone of two different cloud cells. So what we have is the polar easterlies are going to be ripping to the east, obviously, and then what we consider regular weather that moves across from west to east in its pattern are right at that conversion zone. So what we're seeing is a lot of twisting into the atmosphere. And with the sulfur dioxide, it's becoming very, very pronounced in where this cavitation is occurring in these better whirlpools is the best way to look at it in the skies here. Now, these are going to continue to amplify. And the longer it goes, the more it's going to mix the sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. It'll become more of a homogeneous color as we move through these slides here. Give it another 4 months or so, and it should be much more uniform around the top of our planet here.
So the sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, I mean, this is one of the actual global dimming strategies of the globalists to try to block the sun and shut down photosynthesis and food production. This is what they call a stratospheric aerosol injection. But maybe they use a different chemical, or what does this have in common with that?
Exactly the same effect to block sunlight. Now, this was a natural eruption, and the final totals were about 72,000 feet, this eruption. But Bismiani went off at the exact same time, 2 days later, up to 50,000 feet. And Sangay, now south of the equator, at 52,000 feet. So just in the last 2 weeks, we've had three major eruptions that above 50,000 feet, you know, you are going to get regional cooling. But in addition to what Hunga Tonga had thrown out to us with 10% more water vapor in the atmosphere last year from that southern hemisphere, water vapor emission up to 180,000 feet up into the mesosphere and the ice crystal clouds. And now we're combining all these different atmospheric effects from several different eruptions of major proportions over the last year and a half. It's culminating. It's actually really starting to blend in and amplify on itself, one effect amplifying the next.
So let's translate this into real world effects here. So what you're saying is we're going to have, through the water vapor and the sulfur dioxide, we're going to have more blocking of the sun, which will have a cooling effect, as well as denying food crops the normal amount of sunlight that they would use for photosynthesis for plant energy production. So are we talking shorter growing seasons, lower crop yields? What's the actual effect?
Well, we'll know shortly. If you can move the next slide there, you'll start to see the cavitation happening in different regions. If you go two slides forward, we can take a look. And one of the wild cards here is going to be the temperatures. And the temperatures, if they're lower, producing more rainfall, mist, and fog during this time, So what we see is a direct correlation of these sulfur dioxide clouds lowering the temperatures. So the left side, what you're looking at is...
Oh, I'm sorry, there. Okay.
Tropical tidbits. And this is ground temperature. I put it at 2 meters. And on the right side, in the atmosphere, what we're looking at is the sulfur dioxide concentrations at milligrams per cubic meter.
Okay.
So the white out there in the particular slide you're showing, you can see that the it looks like almost a DNA strand running through Europe. And then if you look at the ground temperatures, you can see there's some anomalies. In Scotland, they're wondering why winter's back. It's going to be 17 degrees, possibly 20 degrees in Scotland, starts snowing again, and the temperatures are well below freezing. And they're asking why. Well, this is a perfect example why.
So this effect, though, what are the projections of what this means for food production across Europe and North America?
There's a couple things happening in tandem. So let's layer this off for a second. The first thing that we keep hearing in the news is the rice shortage. It's the biggest shortage in 20 years. But in lockstep, the World Economic Forum and others are coming out saying we need to reduce rice production because it produces more methane. So now you need to stop eating. Like being a vegetarian wasn't good enough now. You know how they convinced everybody,
right.
If you're a vegetarian, don't eat meat. And now they're saying, oh, we even need to stop rice production because it produces too much methane. War on food. But then, you know, we had that massive drought on the Mississippi River where they couldn't even send any grain shuttles down. Lowest water in 110 to 120 years. So they stacked all those grains on the sides of the Mississippi, all up and down the Mississippi, every storage facility full. And what do we have now? Record floods, bringing us back to 1857.
Okay. All right.
That's insane. Because we called this, you know, they're going to go to record low, stack all the grains. And when this fills up, it's going to run down and wash away a bunch of grain. Now, when we come into the planting season, the ozone hole in the southern hemisphere is going to get really wide with a lot of UVB damage from the previous Hunga Tonga eruption. And now delayed plantings or below normal temperatures that are going to swing in and out. And this is something that they had a problem with during the year without a summer. You know, they had these windows that were normal, you know, the regular normal, what you would expect for this time of the year in your local area. But then suddenly they would get, just like you're seeing here, some of these temperatures in those purples and lighter pinks are, you know, 15 to 17 degrees Fahrenheit below the normal. So try to plant into that. Now, what kind of disruptions? Because we're right at the beginning of the most disruption in sunlight because the sulfur dioxide hasn't really mixed at all.
Right.
It's still very concentrated in blobs, if you will, in striations through the atmosphere. And as those pass across zones, it's going to drop temperatures for days at a time. So you're going to get this continuous up and down, up and down, up and down temperatures, dropping 10, 15 Fahrenheit below the normal that they're used to planting into. So I don't know how many times undulations can go around as this thing, you know, continues to move around the planet before the crops just say, wait a minute, it's too cold. Wait, it's warm enough. Okay, it's too cold. No, it's warm enough.
Okay,
looking at disruptions.
But
that, and the last thing I'll say, Mike, is the Ukrainian agricultural minister came out and finally they're looking at about 12% arable land to be planted this year.
That's it?
Well, 12% is what their magic number seems to be,
wow,
to be able to plant into with all the disruptions from the war.
Well, on top of that, though, too, David, we know because of the economic sanctions against Russia, for example, and the natural gas supply shortage because of the destruction of Nord Stream, which the U.S. carried out. And we've seen shutdowns of fertilizer production facilities across Europe. Fertilizer is going to be very difficult to acquire, much more scarce, more pricey, on top of these weather variations. But a key point, I want to confirm this with you, you know, anytime the weather goes crazy, you hear from the media, oh, that's climate change, which it's a meaningless term at this point. But what you're saying is, no, it's volcanoes. It's water vapor and sulfur dioxide. Like these are not man-made effects, let's say. These are, quote, natural disasters and the atmospheric effects causing these undulations in temperature and humidity and so on. Is that correct?
That's correct. And where does it lead to? Well, it leads to digital rationing cards, digital IDs, and central bank digital currencies, because how much have they programmed us over the last 5 years of equity, equality, and all these terms that have been built into daily life? Well, if you're coming to a rationing system, you're certainly going to start throwing those keywords around like, you know, like spare change. And I think that's where it's heading to. Now, the thing is, with all these five large factors heading on together, now, how could you, as a global system of governance that you want to implement, change systems economically and also at the same time terrify people with these food shortages to get them to comply and accept a new way to transact in commerce, CBDCs, and also to abandon an older system that everybody's used to? Nobody's going to go quietly in the night unless several things happen. So I'm trying to game this out. There's all these variables here. We know where it leads to. Now, how do you combine these into that, you know, messaging actions to get humans to move to the stimulus to push them through that cattle gate over there to the end? Chipping.
Along those lines, we've seen New York City Mayor Eric Adams proposing what I think a 25 or 30% reduction in what he calls food emissions, which doesn't even make sense. Again, you know, the terms and phraseology that they use to describe this, it's all imaginary. But what they mean is cutting out all meat. And so they want to do to America what the government of the Netherlands has done there, which is shutting down farms in the name of saving the climate. But again, those farms are not the cause of the weather patterns that you're describing or of the, you know, the crop shortages. It's the dimming of the sun. And plus, we might argue geoengineering is also taking place. So there is some weaponization that can amplify some of the worst effects. So these are engineered food shortages. And then on top of that, government policies come in and they say, oh, we don't want you to eat meat at all. So and also not rice, right? So what are you supposed to eat? I mean, each other? If you live in New York City, what is politically correct to eat at this point? You know, like soybeans or what is it? Your thoughts?
Micro farming is the new term they're giving to insect farming. They're calling it micro farming or micro production of food. I mean, one of the things, this is a serious point here. When they were starting to talk about the geoengineering and the applications of it, both Stanford and Yale, David Keith was a little worried when they started their programs that if there was such large eruptions as we're experiencing now, and they had an ongoing geoengineering program, that the combined runaway effect with all the particulates there combined with this exact same set of sulfur dioxide, they never mentioned water vapor like there was from the Hunga Tonga eruption. But one of their main concerns was it would take about 3 years of drift for everything. If they ceased every program on the geoengineering side of things, it would take about 3 years for everything to drift out of the sky and make it back to ground level. But once you added the sulfur dioxide particulates in conjunction with that, then they were looking at, you know, 2 to 3 years of quote unquote runaway effects. Now, they didn't really define those effects as much as, but I can believe that they were concerned about cooling. So what are we going to eat? Lab engineered foods? I mean, yeah, is this meat geoengineering program going to kick into like a 10X now because all the other natural constituents are up there for them to amplify and ride on top of a natural cycle? That should be the question is, all right, so we have this cooling on the ground that you can see very evident from, you know, the sulfur dioxide drift and the blobs and the striations directly correlated to immediate cooling on the ground. Now, how nefarious would they be to run up a bunch more particulates to help that cool even further and disrupt the agriculture on purpose in order to facilitate all these goals that are
exactly
meant for us to move to, fast track it?
So they can, yeah, exactly. They can amplify all of this, and you're 100% correct, David. But then at the same time, they are dismantling the infrastructure that provides food and energy domestically. I was just covering yesterday in California, they are proposing essentially outlawing all diesel locomotives by the year 2030, or it's in phases, I think 2035 for other things. But they're basically saying they don't want diesel powered trains, which is, you know, all long haul trains are diesel electric trains. And they say they don't want any diesel engines in the state of California. So, I mean, I ask you, David, you know, moving fertilizer, moving grain to ranches and farm animals, moving coal to power plants, moving raw materials for production. No trains means, frankly, no California. I don't know how these people think that they're going to have a functioning economy if they don't have trains. And they also want to ban trucks that have, you know, combustion engines. But there are no battery-powered trains. I don't know what fictional alternate reality they're living in, but they think you can just plug batteries into trains and that's going to work. It doesn't work. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, those are for kids in the basement. But there's this new article I just got here, just came out. CPKS Railroad merger and U.S. wheat exports. So they're going to take the Kansas City Southern Railway Company, KCS, and then combine it with Canadian Pacific Railway Limited, CP. And they're going to have a North American, stretches all the way from Canada. It runs completely east to west through Canada, through the central part, Kansas City, and all the way down into Mexico City, DFA. And this is the North American, you know, there's a huge ramp up in the North American Union talk right now. Well, this is the rail system that's going to combine it and tie it all together for grain deliveries across three nations. That doesn't work on battery power. Not a chance. 0%. I know a couple, you know, dairy persons out in California, and they run everything from Midwest rail out there. So does that mean that they need every single herd needs to leave California if you're not able to bring it by rail into California? I think the answer is quite apparent. It would have to be a yes. So where do you find, you know, 10,000 acres to bring your cattle to if you're going to move out of California and you're going to need to even 1,000 acres, 2,000 acres? Where are you going to just find that to set up and put all the infrastructure in for dairy and get that up and running? Not going to happen in 30 days. I guarantee that.
Well, I mean, it also begs the question. I mean, you're just describing infrastructure that can haul loads between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And you have to have transportation or you have no economy, period. California is shutting down transportation out of this climate cultism for the same reason that New York City is shutting down, you know, meat in the food supply. And it's the same reason the Netherlands are shutting down meat production and other European countries as well. So my concern, and you've kind of hinted at this, but is you've got these insane climate cultist political leaders who are destroying the system at the same time that these volcanoes have erupted, and you've got water vapor, you've got sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, you've got temperature variation there, and the combined effects of this is going to be a runaway feedback loop, a self-reinforcing feedback loop of food doom that none of the politicians are anticipating. So I think I mean, you're the expert, but aren't we going to be seeing record food scarcity and food inflation for years because of this?
Yes. And you know that word hyperinflation, it won't be used in the same sentences because they'll look and go, oh, the furniture, it's not hyperinflation. Look, that chair from whatever furniture store, that only went up 5%. Imagine if your food's not only what if your food runs up 10x and there'll be very specific slots of the economy that will run into hyperinflation, but there'll be other sectors that'll be almost zero affected. There might be some cost increase, very slight. So that'll give them also with the narrative, of course, we're not in a hyperinflationary event. Look, your furniture costs the exact same as it did a year ago.
Well, but plus then, they don't count
that
food.
You're gonna eat off a shelf is 10x more expensive or exactly. 20x more expensive.
Well, food's not even part of the official government inflation numbers.
Nah, that's such a fake number there.
Yeah, it's completely fake, but you're right. I mean, we could be looking at food doubling every 12 months for a couple of years here. You know, 2 years later, could be 400% higher cost.
I'm wondering how they're going to work the narrative in to get the biggest amount of fear and scare out of it to get you to comply to a rationing system. Now, most Americans I know would absolutely be saying, no, that's unacceptable. You give me my thing. I have enough money to buy it. Now, we're going to approach a point here where I don't care if you have the money, it's just not going to be available or it's going to be greatly restricted. You've been trained already. Stand 6 feet apart, get outside the store. And as we march through this sort of hyperinflationary food event or inavailability or there's going to be many variables to it. You'll probably have to prove funds before you can go in because there'll be flash mobbing and rioting. We spoke about this last year and it's very close to what we had talked about at this point right now. And you'll probably have to show some sort of ID. Now, I don't know in the beginning, you know, your driver's license will probably be good enough until they get you onto a digital ID system, which will need to be presented with proof of funds. Now, perhaps that could take on the you know, something with a CBDC role in that. But to just wander into the stores and go shopping freely Your days of that are very limited. We're coming into a point where it's going to be controlled on purpose, because you need to be controlled to get you into the new system, because you will not go quietly.
Well, you're exactly right. We saw that during COVID, where a lot of grocery stores set up the infrastructure to bring the food to you in the parking lot. And I can see that transitioning to where you're not even allowed to enter the store. So, okay, it's like, you give us your order, you give us your money, you wait in your car. If we approve, then we'll bring you the food, but you don't even come in the store. And if we don't approve, you're just not going to get anything. Good luck, you know, have fun. And they will put in restrictions, especially on so-called emissions producing food, like meat products, as they're doing in New York City. So you'll be limited to, you know, 1 pound of ground beef a week or something, let's say, or one dozen eggs a week. You get the idea. Or 1 gallon of milk, whatever it is. And that will be enforced through the digital wallet system that they're trying to drive everybody into. And I can also see, David, that the universal basic income that they're going to have to start pushing because of massive joblessness and layoffs across, well, I mean, we're talking about an engineered collapse of the economy, but the UBI will be through the digital system, and it will say, okay, here's credit for you to buy food, but by taking this credit, you agree to our restrictions of which foods you're allowed to buy. And so that's the people sign up for that Mark of the Beast system. They're going to be told what they can and can't purchase. You think that's coming?
I do. And then even if you are able to purchase it and they bring out, you know, let's say I want 2 tomatoes or, you know, some celery or whatever it is that you're going to get. And then what if they bring you out wilted, almost completely rotten? You have 12 hours to use this or else the worms are going to start coming out of the skin kind of thing. You're not going to have a choice when somebody else provides you the food. You're not going to walk through and go, no, that looks a little old. I'll take this one. I'll take those days of choice will be gone. You'll be given what you get. And you will be thankful for what you get.
So this is straight up communism.
Go ahead.
This is straight up communism. This is centrally controlled government food lines, just a little more elegant. But it's the same thing. This is communist food.
Yeah, it'll be an elegant line. After all, it's America. It's the most prosperous nation, freest country in the world. So it'll have to be elegant while we stand in line, won't it? They'll probably have bells and whistles and, you know, but what's going to be the easiest thing to implement first to get people to believe the story of scarcity? So we have five events running out there. Which one's going to get the first throw, if you will, to get people to believe that we are actually in a shortage that will manifest visibly for them? To tell them there's a war in Ukraine, okay, we didn't see much grain disruption in the United States or Canada. Okay, the UVB radiation event and runaway ozone depletion event in the Southern Hemisphere. Okay, that's kind of in the Southern Hemisphere. We don't get it. So what's the thing that's going to be the catalyst for the rest of the Western world, i.e., you know, the Five Eyes nations, to get everybody believing that this is such a catastrophic food shortage? Because a 20-year, you know, the biggest rice shortage in 20 years, big whoop. Most people, you know, that's not their daily. So how are we going to get them to... What's going to be the first thing to run with, and how's the messaging going to come out in point A, point B? Because they're going to eventually feed in on each other as a swirling loop of its own warped consciousness that's going to spread out. You know, something's going to have to be the first to get the messaging out there that we are having the shortages. I really believe it's the sulfur dioxide in those slides that I'd sent you. You know, that one that's at the Middle East, you know, Mike, if you could look for that one right there, that is of the Middle East.
I don't know which slide number is that.
Cleanly. Yeah, because it was going, it's really, you know, it's hot now in the Middle East. But when we see these direct, you know, concentrations of CO2 directly cooling right over desert areas, that's a little bit of
Can you give me a slide number? I can't really. It's hard to determine the map lines.
Slide number 12.
Okay, slide number 12. All right, bringing it up. Here we go. Oh, there we go. Yeah, Egypt. All right.
So all you have to do is follow the white arrows. So you can do it reverse, or you can do it backwards or forwards. You can look at the sulfur dioxide concentrations over the landmass, and then map that up with the cooling on the regular temperature delta, which is, you know, those are in degrees Celsius, by the way, for those of you watching in the States. So something that's 12 to say 16 degrees Celsius is near 20 degrees below the normal temperature.
Wow.
Or you can map it up and just go, okay, the cold's there, so there must be sulfur dioxide over there. And if you run through the different, if you go to slide 13 also, you go down talking about Mexico here.
Well, wait a minute. Before we get there, back on slide 12, what we're looking at here. So these arrows show, okay, on the left, these are temperatures. It's cooler. And on the right is the sulfur dioxide concentration. Is that correct?
Over very specific areas that are showing very specific cooling in the exact same days that one actually is a catalyst for the other.
Wow. Right. I mean, this is inarguable. okay. So yeah, you block the sun, things get cooler, which means all the global warming alarmists have it backwards. Warming is not the threat right now following these volcanoes. It's actually a cooling threat, at least for the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, that's right. And if you go, I'll show you a couple more, which I found of interest. Slide 13.
Okay.
It's a little bit wider out, and it encapsulates Mexico, going down into southern Mexico. And as you know, right now, it should be a bit warmer than those temperatures, where we're still getting the same, 12 to 16 degree Celsius below normal temperatures. And what's so interesting about that is then if you follow it up into Texas and you take the very lightest of yellow up to the Great Lakes, I mean, it shows cooling in that exact, it's almost, carbon copy of itself. And if you go offshore of the U.S. and you start looking a little bit below the Maritimes of Canada and you see that dark blue blob in the ocean on the temperature map.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
right
everywhere
here.
This sulfur dioxide cloud is traveling, it is cooling temperatures. Some greater cooling than others, but there is an effect.
Yep.
Everywhere this cloud's mass is moving. Now, this is just the beginning of it. It's going to continue to, like I say, blend and become more of a homogeneous yellow throughout the cap of our planet here.
Wow. So, right. So for how long will these sulfur dioxide particles stay suspended? And do we know what altitude that they're at roughly? What layer of the atmosphere?
Yeah, I'm still trying to work that out because it seems that the higher the concentration, the more they have sunk. It's a little bit lower into the atmosphere versus something that's a little bit lighter that can be buoyed up there somewhere between 30 and 50,000 feet.
Okay, so not crazy high, kind of like high altitude storm level, basically, but not stratosphere. So maybe only 1 to 2 years of an effect, or is that reasonable?
Yeah, 18 months is kind of the conjecture right now for a lot of people that have studied volcanoes in the past, including Pinatubo, El Chinchon, Agun, these types of eruptions that we've seen in the Efenhul, the one that went off in Europe many years ago, about 10 years ago or so, 12 years ago. These types of regional eruptions that we've dealt with in the past.
But then the question is, David,
in this event that have also really done a lot of work in, analysis of the last eruptions have put this at around 18 months.
Okay.
Give or take a few.
But then what about the idea that there are more eruptions happening now and a lot of tectonic plate shifting, influences from outside the planet, gravity, there are magnetic interferences that can alter the flow of the core of the Earth that can also affect that. All this energy coming from the sun affects us in not just light, but also, we have the magnetosphere and that gets affected back within the core of the Earth. I know it's a very, very complex subject. I'm not, an expert in this area, but are you seeing greater frequency of volcanic eruptions, and are volcanologists predicting more frequent volcano eruptions?
Well, if you go to slide 24, I'll directly answer that with the changes in the sun electromagnetically. If you were going to have something that was a planetary disturbance in the magnetic field, you would absolutely see that. And just this is Mercury that started to put off an ion tail. Comets glow with tails, not generally planets in our solar system, but I will say Velikovsky, Worlds in Collision, great book, if nobody's read it, but he talks about Venus being a captured comet that came into our solar system. So I'm seeing here, a sodium ion tail glowing off of Mercury, that's definitely a change in our electromagnetic sphere. And please remember, our star is a regional star right here in our solar system, but it's connected electromagnetically to others along Birkeland currents and filaments through our local star region here. So it's not just we sit here as our own encapsulated ball of plasma that's, you know, throwing off heat, we are connected electromagnetically down a chain further out afield. That's why they're looking at star fields further, you know, back 4 light years, 10 light years, because those are the ones that are closest into us. So when they start to see changes in, you know, luminescence of those bodies that are very close to us, then they would expect the same energetic patterns to sweep through our local system here in our solar system.
Well, what does this slide, I mean, this is fascinating. What does this mean? I mean, you know, I look at the night sky a lot because I live out in the country, and I've never, with the naked eye, I've never noticed a tail coming off of Mercury or Venus. But are you saying that in this case, this ion tail, was this visible with the naked eye, or did you have to just have long exposure photography, or how would you see this?
It just started a week ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the solar winds, when we had that really intense geomagnetic event here, this tail turned on. It turned off again,
wow.
Too, by the way.
Wow.
So it just came. Yeah, it turned on. Remember, we had the CMEs and they were seeing, you know, this is the third set of CMEs, by the way, that has had auroras glowing all the way down to, let's say, Arizona. We saw some in Florida back at the end of last month in March. You know, really low latitude auroral displays, which is incredibly, yeah, incredibly rare anyway. But to have three right. instances of it in less than 2 months.
So,
you know, and it got tails on the planet. There's just a lot of changes. Now, again, if you were trying to explain away all this, to not have a populist panic until you want them to panic, then you would have to generate excuses in advance of all these natural occurrences happening, i.e. global warming. Like for me, I look back as a real simple. They knew these changes would be here, where what we're seeing today is what we're seeing. So to create an excuse for it, so they, oh, that's global warming, that's you, you caused that, versus, oh, by the way, the electromagnetic field of the entire solar system and our regional star system is shifting a little bit.
So
wait a
second.
It does this on a cycle. It's mappable. And these are the direct effects over history here in the last 6,000 years that we see every one of these events.
Right.
But continue to pay your taxes and keep investing. That's
so
not going to work. There
sun cycles, then. We got to talk about the sun. What's happening with the sun? What, I mean, a lot of people are familiar with like the 12-year cycle, but there are much longer cycles. So is the sun beginning its own, you know, coronal mass ejection frequency cycle that is a multi-century cycle at this point, or what's going on with the sun?
Well, currently, most, including NASA, European Space Agency, independent researchers, solar physicists, all agree that as we come out of this solar cycle 25, a lot of people believe we are at the apex of it and years short jumping into the solar minimum. Some others say, no, it's going to be super long. But whatever happens, however long this rest of this solar cycle is, as we enter into the bottom in the solar minimum, we're going to get 1.5 to possibly 2 full solar cycles with some of the lowest solar activity in 400 years.
And how?
That's agreed on. They were putting a maximum sunspot, six. NASA even admitted 6 sunspot average for some months. 6. That's insane. That's so far beyond. All of our weather systems would spin completely out of control, which they are beginning to now.
So if we have, hold on, because some of this seems contradictory. You're saying the solar minimum is about to emerge. And I can see how that
as we taper off and we come down in on the regular 11-year solar cycle. Yeah, we're at the max.
Okay.
Right now with solar
cycle.
Oh,
we're at the max right now,
25.
But the minimum is coming in. Okay,
yeah,
then that makes sense.
And come in. Remember, there's, like you said, there's the regular 11-year solar cycle. But those can be combined into heavier, more powerful cycles as
right.
well.
Right. Okay, got it. Yeah, there are multiple cycles running at the same time. This is like wave theory, right? Multiple cycles with different durations or different wavelengths, and sometimes they oscillate together, sometimes they nullify each other, right? But what you're saying is that there's a solar minimum that's coming that it is both a short-term minimum and a longer-term minimum, and combined with sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, it seems like we could be moving into some real dramatic cooling and short growing seasons and ice. I mean, lots of ice. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you look back at the historical record, it seems that these, you know, prolonged periods of very low solar activity are accompanied by some of the larger sets of eruptions. If you look at 535 and 536 AD, this was another period that has been earmarked of large volcanic eruptions during low solar activity that onset for some period of decline for the civilization of that period that had to reemerge after the crop losses, the population declines, the government restructuring, and the economy shattered, and then had to reestablish trade routes and things of value on what you consider like a tradable asset class at that time.
Well, we are most certainly going to have to reestablish an asset class because the world's fiat currencies are collapsing. I mean,
I know. Now, Mike, I know we're running out of time. Is there any way I could take you to slide 17 real
quick? Of course, you are in command, David. I am just your clicker here. You tell me where to go. 17?
17.
All right, we're at 17.
All right, so at the furthest there, you know, Bangladesh, the news stories right now are about how cold it is and how unprepared for people with the cool right now that should be going into a much warmer time, should be scalding hot, but it's not. So they also had a lot of problems with people not being accustomed to the cold during the regular Northern Hemisphere winter, like December, January. People were getting, you know, frostbite on the toes, cold. They just weren't prepared for the cold. But where you're looking at the sulfur dioxide concentrations in eastern India, like Arunachal Pradesh and Assam and that area, Nagaland, you see where it's cooler because the sulfur dioxide. This moves every day. These are just snapshots in time.
Right.
But the one for me that was really clean was right in central China there, that you can see the actual, looks like a looping strip along going on over to the coast. And another interesting thing is if you look offshore into the Pacific there, you can see where the sulfur dioxide line ceases over on the right side, but you'll see where the temperature, you can overlap those at 100% correlation on offshore as well, where the line of sulfur dioxide ceases and where that below normal temperature ceases and comes back into some sort of normalcy where there's cleaner air without the sulfur dioxide drift in it.
Right. This edge right here. Okay. And this temperature edge, that is really something. So this is something, you know, the weatherman on TV or the network news, they never talk about sulfur dioxide affecting temperatures. The public doesn't know any of this. It's incredible.
I'll have two more for you. If you can go to slide number 20.
All right, you got it.
Since you seem to like that offshore correlation here, I got a good one for you.
All right, let's do it.
All right, so if you're looking a little bit below Iceland on the left slide here, and you'll see where the temperature barrier is between the white, and it looks like on your temperature maps, so you're looking for something very specific. You're going to get this stair step effect.
Uh-huh.
Generally, that is extremes in temperature. Normally, you would see that, and like you said, these large thunderheads that are rolling up 30,000 feet, and then on the peripheries, it'll be really warm, but you're getting that cooling in the updrafts. You'll get that kind of stair step thing in certain fronts. But that is really something special to see, this stair stepping. That's extremes in temperature. And then if you follow the white arrow down to a wider view of the sulfur dioxide, you can see where that boundary is, you know, a little bit wider out view, really clean. And then you see a little bit cooler over the Scandinavian nations there. And again, you know, these sulfur dioxides roll through, and it's just going to continually swirl around. So you can do this for the next, you know, 6-8 months of just following the concentrations around the planet, where the cool events will happen in almost real time.
Man, you should launch a hedge fund that is called like the volcanic hedge fund. So when a volcano erupts, you can project what's going to happen to food, commodities, energy prices, energy consumption, cooling. Seriously, you're good at this, David. And just like one volcano will set into motion, just cause and effect, that almost nobody's paying attention to this. But it drives so many things. It's incredible.
You know, I have one more here. This is going to drive China. Slide 22, you have Kazakhstan and Mongolia right in the center there.
Mm-hmm.
And I drew the white arrow to the large striation making a funnel in the atmosphere. And then you can see the same atmospheric pattern in the temperature reflected. I could first, you know, but Tropical Tidbits didn't have that bit further north that I really wanted to get there.
Oh, yeah.
But you can see how the cavitation, they're both bending in the same exact direction. They're taking on the same shape in the atmosphere.
Right. Fascinating.
So this is going to swing over China, and they're already having a problem with crop production. So you just have to wonder, if this continues, now if this rolls through the entire planting season and mid-maturation season, how much, let's say the plants do emerge, how much stress can they really take from going 15 degrees swing below normal back to normal temperatures, 15 degrees, 20 degrees below normal back to normal temperatures? Like, how much temperature swinging can plants really handle before they start to go, whoa, we're going to conserve a little energy here. We're not going to throw off as much grain head this year.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. I mean, it affects yields. It affects pollination, and it affects nutrient value. So even if the crops come out, even if they're produced, they may not be as nutritious, and you can have, you know, nutritional deficiencies, especially in marginal countries that are just barely getting by. I mean, I know you know all this. I'm stating this for the audience. So David, we only have a minute or two left here. What's the big summary of this? This is fascinating stuff, but what's the takeaway?
You know, one of the main things, we're going to have to grow food.
Absolutely.
And you know, tell others about this event that's ongoing. So when they start to see it in the news and the whatever way it's spun, that, you know, more people can grow food together than a single person can. That's going to be one of your, and you're going to have to learn how to store foods and how to store seeds properly. But just the number one takeaway is this is going to be weaponized. This information is going to be weaponized to get you to a new system, a digital system, a ration system. So I can just envision, like I spoke about, you know, we've got these five major events in the climate happening right now that are all pointing to lower yields in the crops around the planet, whether it be rice or whether it's barley or whether it's wheat or corn. But then the periphery crops like barley, spelt, millet, sorghum, these are definitely going to have some real cascading effects. And a lot of developing nations use this as their main staple crop. So you can see food inflation running in a lot of developing nations. But just know this is going to be used as a weapon against you. So if you can understand the mechanisms behind it, then it's not scary.
Right.
It's very doable because you know the time frame of it.
Okay, so learn to grow food, create stronger local food communities, save seeds, trade seeds, support local agriculture and farmers, and maybe become your own local farmer, and don't fall for the propaganda. Is that a pretty good summary?
You summed that all up. Okay, I don't even need to do the interview. Thanks, Mike.
No, but these are just the bullet points, the takeaways. But now, thanks to your help, people understand exactly what's going on. And my concern is there are going to be more volcanic eruptions and more material in the atmosphere blocking more sunlight, and that this whole situation could get even worse than what you've presented here today. But we'll stay in touch with you, David. Just want to give people your channel. Adapt 2030 is your channel. David Dubine also has a show with us on Brighteon.tv, which is outstanding. His channel, Adapt 2030, is on all the major platforms. You can check him out there. Any other direct website, David, you want to give out?
The Mini Ice Age Conversations podcast, and that's anywhere podcasts are hosted across the net. I think I'm on episode 405 right now. They're all 30-minute episodes, just longer in-depth. You know, and I have a live radio program every Thursday night on Revolution Radio, 10 p.m. to midnight, where a co-host and myself, we try to make sense of these same things and game it out. We want to game it out. We want to live-action role-play. Like, you know the end goal's here. We're here. So how are they going to move us through and drag us over to there, whether you want to go or not? You know, and then there's possibilities to move out of the way while others are getting dragged, and maybe snatch a couple of them by the collar and pull them back on this side so they're not all swept into the chaos.
Oh, it is going to be quite a lot of chaos. But folks, if you grow food and you know how to preserve food, then you don't have to freak out. You don't have to panic. This is really about solutions. So thank you, David, for sharing time with us today. I'm sorry we got to wrap it up, but this has been fascinating. We'll do it again soon.
Hey, thank you.
All right. And for those of you watching, as always, we thank you for watching, and you can share this interview on other channels. I mean, you can repost it if you wish. And I want to show you just what we're doing, our part here. We are about to make a major donation to two groups. We're donating about $150,000 worth of food and supplements. And you can show my screen here. Group number one is called Convoy of Hope. And they distribute food worldwide, but also in the United States. And then the second group is Harvest Time Ministries, which is, they're based out of Florida. I think I have the right website for them here. And they provide food to food banks in the United States. And I'm going to shoot a video here in just a few minutes showing our donations. And they begin shipping out actually on Monday. So I think the same day that we're going to be releasing this video. So we're trying to help as best we can, but help yourself first by growing food. And thank you for watching today. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com. And we've been talking with David Dubine of Adapt 2030. Take care, everybody. A global reset is coming. And that's why I've recorded a new 9-hour audiobook. It's called The Global Reset Survival Guide. You can download it for free by subscribing to the naturalnews.com email newsletter, which is also free. I'll describe how the monetary system fails. I also cover emergency medicine and first aid and what to buy to help you avoid infections. So download this guide. It's free. It's my gift to you simply because I want like-minded people to survive.